Hello, and welcome to episode 9 of Desi Books, news and views about Desi literature from the world over. I'm your host, Jenny Batt. Thank you for tuning in. In today's episode, in addition to the usual roundup of new notable Desi books, short stories, poems, essays, interviews, awards, and more, we have Sejal Shah discussing the literary essay form and her new essay collection, This Is One Way to Dance. And Fawzia Karimi is reading from and offering one free copy of her new novel, Above Us, the Milky Way. So let's get started. Notable new books for June. You can find all the titles mentioned in this new books segment at bookshop.org, which benefits local independent booksellers directly. Go to bookshop.org/lists/desi-books-2020. This is a US-based site, so my apologies to non-US listeners. First up, I've already mentioned Sejal Shah, who has a new collection out titled This Is One Way to Dance. These are personal essays written over a couple of decades about her different identities as Indian American, brown, woman, Gujarati, friend, daughter, sister, wife, and more. And I'll link to a new excerpt from that collection at Mason Street Review. Megha Majumdar has a debut novel out titled A Burning. Told through the eyes of mainly three characters, this is a story about justice, morality, politics, class, religion, and identity. And there's an excerpt I'll link to at the Literary Hub. Gopi Chand Narang and Surinder Deol have a book out called The Urdu Ghazal, A Gift of India's Composite Culture, and it's about the evolution of this form of music with all of its many influences from the 14th century on. Sonia Shah's new book, The Next Great Migration, The Beauty and Terror of Life on the Move, is about the science and history of migration in animals, plants, and humans. And you can read an excerpt at the New York Times. Annie Zedi's memoir, Bread, Cement, Cactus, A Memoir of Belonging and Dislocation, is out in the UK now, in print, and it will be available in other countries soon. It's about the meaning of home, with reflections about all of the places that Zedi has called home. And the e-book version of Anand Mahadevan's memoir, Once Upon a Prime Time, is out now. You can read an excerpt at scroll.in. And anyone who grew up in India in the 80s will remember this TV, movie, and stage actor. And this excerpt focuses on an era when literary short stories were adapted frequently for television in India. Next, we have some new notable stories, poems, and essays from literary magazines and websites. I know I'm not getting them all, so if you know of some of these being published online by South Asian writers, please share them by tagging the Desi Books Twitter account, which I'll link to in the transcript. Thank you. Rita Mukherjee has a poem up at The Offing magazine called The Stranger's Guide to Brothels of Philadelphia, 1849. It's a lovely sensory feast of imagined history. Atif Rashid has another thought-provoking column up at the Kenyon Review about the line between critique and endorsement. And really, there's enough to fill a book and more on this topic in the book world, I'm sure. Sarah Siddiqui Chansarkar has a haunting personal essay up at Pigeonholes about getting back home after her dear Abu is no longer there to greet her. Anita Gill has a jaunty personal essay also up at the Offing about wanting to learn the North Indian dance of Bhangra. And Maddie Crowell has an illuminating narrative at the Virginia Quarterly Review online about how the gutsy Indian magazine The Caravan has made its place in the country while putting out tough political stories and more. Last week, we saw the first ever South Asian Literary Festival started or founded by Dr. Pragya Agarwal from the UK. And this brief essay by her at the bookseller is about the whys and wherefores, and it's worth a read. Ginny Reddy's essay at The Guardian about why white men got to travel more and publish more travel writing ends with a hopeful and optimistic note for more diverse writers being given the opportunities to do the same. Asfar Hussain writes about the Bangladeshi poet Qazi Nazrul Islam's non-fiction prose at the Daily Star and how it's insurgent and insurrectionary. Malvika Banerjee summarizes a Zoom chat session with Amitabh Ghosh about the cyclone Amphan, climate change, and more at Telegraph India. Aishwarya Sahasrabhude writes about a new translation of Sunil Gangopadhyay's classic novel, Blood, from the Bengali by Dibali Mukherjee Leonard. In notable new interviews and awards, we have Sejal Shah, who was interviewed by Anjali Anheti at The Literary Hub about her new essay collection, This Is One Way to Dance. Sudeep Sen was interviewed by Natalie Handel at Words Without Borders about the city Delhi and his poems on it. And the 2020 Commonwealth Short Story Prize has announced their regional winners. So Kritika Pandey has won for Asia with her story titled The Great Indian Tea and Snakes. You can watch her discussing it at a YouTube video, which I'll link to in the transcript. In today's Desi Craft Chat segment, I'm talking with Sejal Shah. Shah is the author of the debut essay collection, This Is One Way to Dance. Her stories and essays have appeared or are forthcoming in Brevity, Conjunctions, Guernica, the Kenyan Review Online, Literary Hub, Long Reads, and The Rumpus. The recipient of a 2018 New York Foundation for the Arts Fellowship in Fiction, Sejal recently completed a story collection and is at work on a memoir about mental health and academia. She's on the faculty of the Rainier Writing Workshop Low Residency MFA program at Pacific Lutheran University. She lives in Rochester, New York, and you can find her on Twitter and Instagram at FictionalSejal. In this craft chat, Sejal and I talked about the essay form, particularly the lyric essay form, and she shared how her own craft has evolved through the writing of these essays in her new collection over a period of time. With that, settle in, and I hope you enjoy the conversation. So welcome, Sejal, and thank you for being a part of this podcast and this particular series, Desi Craft Chat. I'm very excited to talk with you about your new upcoming
essay collection, This Is One Way to Dance. I've been reading it and definitely very interested in talking more with you about the craft of the essay and specifically the lyric essay. I think I've read some other interviews where you've discussed the lyric essay. So I'll start with the first question. And this is a little bit of a long one, but let me just get into it. I've always said that before we become writers, we're obviously readers, and we bring, as always, our personal experiences to our reading, as indeed to our writing. But that said, we do experience both fiction and nonfiction differently when we read. And I'm thinking about Philip LePate's point in his book To Show and Tell, The Craft of Literary Nonfiction. And I'll just read that one quote out because he writes about how, in the traditional short story or novel, a fictive space is opened up that allows you, the reader, to disappear into the action, even to the point of forgetting that you're reading. But in the best nonfiction, it seems to me, you're always made aware that you are being engaged with a supple mind at work. And he goes on to say that for him, the pleasure of reading nonfiction is to encounter a well-stocked mind and an evolved, elegant, highly intentional, I beg your pardon, literary style. So what I was curious about is how you experience fiction and nonfiction differently as a reader, a writer, and a writing professor.
It's a great question, Jenny. Thank you. I thought I would focus on nonfiction because that's what I've been working on and teaching in the last few years. But I also returned to fiction writers like Alice Adams, and I've been thinking about her work a lot lately. There's a book of hers called Return Trips that I especially like. But her stories are often in first person point of view, and they sound as if they could be nonfiction. So that's something I think that's kind of interesting about her as a writer that I appreciate. The last story in the book is called My First and Only House, and it's a story that I've taught many times, and I've taught it in nonfiction classes also, because it sounds, there's a lot of musing in it. The speaker is trying to figure out why has this house that she only lived in as a child stayed with her for so long. And it's just a few pages, it's quite short. So for me, writing nonfiction is a kind of excavation, working from fragments and looking for associations between objects. I think in fiction, it's more about image and voice, following a voice, a character, a place, and there's more combining of elements. I'm not trying to make sense of it in the same way as a writer. It's more following the logic of a dream and knowing there's a reason that these different elements have come together. There's a sense of play for me. With writing nonfiction, again, it feels like a kind of excavation, working from fragments and looking for association between objects. In the brief essay that I have in my book, Curriculum, that's also been classified as a short story by other people. And I link a handkerchief of a map of British East Africa and my mother's eyeglasses and a buffalo baking powder box and latch hook and soap operas, these artifacts. I'm interested in what do we hold on to and what do they mean? Nonfiction for me has elements that I've been thinking about lately of them as visible mending.
So the as Lopate says, the mind, how are we thinking about something? For the introduction to my book, I used Margaret Atwood's Nine Beginnings as a kind of template. Do you know that essay?
I do, yes, yes. In fact, I think I featured it in one of my columns at Pop Matters.
Yeah,
yes. I'll link to it in the transcript as well.
Oh, great. So. I love that essay. And when I was writing my introduction, my editors asked me to write an introduction to provide some connective tissue for the book. I first had it numbered. And in fact, in the title, I think I referred to Nine Beginnings. And she's answering that question, right? Why do you write? And I appreciated that that was showing the underlying structure of the essay and that Atwood chose to keep that scaffolding and structure visible. And I kept that in mind with, you know, why did I write this book? Why are they essays written over 20 years? Why did I focus on certain things? And eventually I chose to remove the numbers in the introduction. And I left a note at the end of the book that referred to Nine Beginnings as a model that I used, because I felt that the numbers were distracting in the introduction. But it was a way of engaging with an essay that I've loved for a long time.
You know, and so to your what you've just said about how you know, you mentioned the word fragments a couple times, and I want to just catch on to that. I noticed you did that quite a bit in a number of the essays in the collection. I'm thinking of how you take different things, whether it's artifacts or ideas, and you were just connecting them. You were bringing that connective tissue and making us see them in a different way, whether it was that essay that you had on the one that just got published.
Betsy Tacy Sagel, too.
What was it? Betsy yes, that's the one. But I wanted to get that order right. I was thinking I'm going to get it wrong. But yeah, Betsy Tacy Sagel, too. And you kind of brought different things together and, you know, you kind of made us look at the whole thing in a different way. And the same goes for, and I'm not good at remembering titles of essays, but the one you wrote about your marriage ceremony.
Oh, Sorries and Sorrows, yeah.
Where... That's it, Sorries and Sorrows. And, you know, you brought together so many different aspects and connected them all so that it just gave us an idea of this wedding that was so much more than just, you know, the big fat Indian wedding,
right.
You know? You know, and you've also said in your recent Kenyon Review interview that the lyric essay is where you found a home. And I want to talk about the definition that you picked up there, because again, it has that word fragments. And you mentioned that essay from Seneca Review. Let me read a bit of that out for our listeners. I'll link it to your Kenyon Review interview in the transcript as well. But it's a cross between the essay and the lyric poem, which is how you've defined it, or they've defined it, I guess. And it's storyless. It may spiral in on itself, circling the core of a single image or idea without climax, without a paraphrasable theme. And they explained that lyric essays also work through the accretion of fragments. And so, as I said, this is certainly true of many of the essays in your collection as you explore your own sense of identity as a woman, a brown woman, a professor, a daughter, a lover, a wife, friend. So when you're doing this kind of spiraling or circling or accretion of fragments while writing a lyric essay, what would you say is the hardest or the most challenging aspect? And what is the aspect that continues to pull you into practicing the form?
I love this question. I did want to circle back, though, to Betsy Tacy Sagel Tibb. Would this be a time to do it, or would you? Could we return?
No, please go ahead.
Just
yeah.
Because I just focused in my answer on nonfiction, and Betsy Tacy Sagel Tibb, of course, is based on the Betsy Tacy books, but that essay used to be a short story. And I thought this might be interesting to hear that in lengthening it and making it into an essay, I did it through writing about imagining a series of middle grade or young adult books. And so that's an example of nonfiction using elements of fiction, right? I think certainly nonfiction writers do that, and for myself, that is my training, and my MFA is in fiction. But these imagined stories, like the mystery of the Prasad plate and the Gujarati girls go to India, just these different titles, and imagining these stories. I love what fiction offers room to play and not to be constrained by whether or not something actually happened. And certainly after my mother read my book, I had a moment of thinking, well, that's why an earlier version of my manuscript was half short stories and half essays, and they weren't labeled as to which is which. And I miss that, not having the story attached to you, but just going by what makes a good story. Does that make sense?
Yes, no, I totally get it. And I think, you know, you and I have talked a little bit on Twitter about another one of your essays, which was also initially a short story, with, you know, the one that I think I first read of your work, which was Skin. So, yeah, no, I get what you're saying, yeah.
So to go back to the lyric essay, or to go forward to the lyric essay, of course it has all these fragments. I think, so I only learned of the term lyric essay in 2011, and then later realized what I had been writing for a long time. At least some of what I had written could fall under that definition. I love that the lyric essay respects what may not make sense, what doesn't make sense or can't be paraphrased in our lives, what stays with us. I pay attention to what I've collected over the years, what's on my desk, my bookshelves, especially after years of moves, what do they mean, right? What have I kept? What kind of story do they tell about my life? Noy Holland, who was one of my grad school fiction professors, also, I remember, told us this in class, to remember to look at what we collect, that it's a key in some way to our stories. I recently heard from a friend who's reading my book, and she asked me about the essay Street Scene and said that she had to reread it because she had trouble with the different, there are a few different threads in that essay. And I think in that particular essay, the inclusion of an image, the image of a childhood pool, is the greatest imaginative leap. So I think some of what's hardest is deciding which elements are part of the initial drafting and which are the heart of the story. At some point in the drafting process, I think, you know, I often have everything in the kitchen sink in an essay, and then there's a lot of carving away, excavating, stepping back, and figuring out how things fit together and how they reveal stories that only become evident after, in some of these essays, a long period of time, in which I asked, how do these pieces relate? What do they say about me or my life? And what is the story or image really about?
Yeah, I haven't written, I would say, I don't think I write lyric essays, but I've written essays. And I find, as I read your collection and a few other lyric essays, you know, that there's a meditative quality to them, which I believe has to come from letting that essay breathe and sit for quite some time. And you've just confirmed that by saying that, you know, the story becomes evident after a certain amount of time. Unlike, I think, the kind of essay that I write, generally, I'm trying to, you know, explore an issue or a problem, and usually by the end of the essay, once I've gone through it and drafted and edited it a few times, I think I'm at a place where I understand what that issue is all about. But I think what you're telling me, if I'm understanding correctly, is, you know, you probably go through your drafting and editing phase, and then you still have to let it sit for a while and then come back to it. And that's what these essays you've got in the collection are, over a number of years, and you've come back to them, and when you put your collection together and you've kind of seen other things and edited them a bit differently, perhaps. Would that be, am I guessing that correctly?
It's a great question, actually. I think that in my book, there's a division. There are different kinds of essays. So a few of them were actually written very, very quickly. Thank You is one of those, and it could be called a lyric essay. Curriculum was pretty fast also, and Things People Said, another one about my wedding, I wrote it and sent it out the same day. So I think that there were a few essays. Skin also came. I mean, though there were some essays that were faster, and then some essays took a much longer time. So I almost think of them in different categories.
Mm. Okay, that makes sense. So okay, so let me ask you. You know, speaking of, you know, how you are thinking mm-hmm. about the lyric essay, this is my next question. I've always believed, I do a lot of, you know, book reviews, and I've always believed that a review or a work of criticism is a literary form of writing in itself. And, you know, I've had to defend that a couple times. But, you know, despite the many variations that we see out there, you know, whether it's listicles or whatever, that people talk of as if they're literary criticism, but they're not. So in that vein, what would be your one big belief about the lyric essay form that you would defend no matter what?
Well, I love that there's room for uncertainty, but I think from that Seneca Review definition, I also love the loyal to the original sense of the essay as a test or quest, an attempt at making sense. So that really the making sense for the narrator is part of the project itself. And also from the definition, the depends on gaps. I think particularly for like writing about trauma and grief, that there are certain states and stories where it's difficult to tell a story directly. And the lyric essay acknowledges this through that definition, that there's room for what can't be said within what is said. And the third thing I'm thinking about from the definition, I went back and looked at it again before our interview, but that it's, it says the lyric essay is never content to merely explain or confess. It elucidates through the dance of its own delving. So there's dance in there, that the journey and the dance of the mind, making sense or surveying what is beyond sense.
How perfect is that? I forgot the word dance in there, and you know, and how perfectly it applies to your book. So that's great. Mm-hmm. So coming to the personal essay, and obviously, you know, it's a genre that's been around for decades. We've seen many variations of this form. We've also seen many attacks on this form, whether it was Virginia Woolf, you know, being caustic about the decay of essay writing, or Gia Tolentino declaring, you know, that the personal essay boom is over a few years ago. But of course, they still persist. And in today's environment, with everything going on, when we're all mostly homebound, there are more of these than ever, it seems. So as a writing teacher and a practitioner, what are one of the, you know, what are like maybe one or two key pieces of advice you'd share with the novice essayist out there?
I think practicing low stakes writing, which for me has been journaling. I've really lost that actually since the pandemic started, and it's made me feel less steady to not have that practice. So I, in the 80s, when I was in high school, I read Natalie Goldberg's Writing Down the Bones. And I loved how she compared just timed writing to sitting meditation. Julia Cameron also wrote The Artist's Way as morning pages. I did that for a long time. So I think just keeping a practice of moving the pen on the page is the first thing I'd say. And when I'm teaching, I often will sometimes do timed writing in class. And I think especially now with, you know, with us on devices and screens so much, it's really important to get back to that, the physical act of writing with a pen or a pencil. I would say number two, I think that gives us a chance also to separate generative and playful and whatever writing from the critical mind, right? And so the second is, this is from Anne Lamott, right? But shitty first drafts, allow whatever, you just want to get to 400 words or 3 pages or whatever arbitrary or non-arbitrary number you make for yourself, so that it becomes a practice. And finally, if you keep writing about something and you don't know why, I would encourage young writers or people perhaps who haven't been writing as long, just to trust it, that there's a story there, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, and there are probably many.
Yeah, no, that last is a very good point. I've always said that, you know, you want to know a writer personally, check out their writing, because their preoccupations,
yes,
are all right there, right? I mean, they're all there. So great. So lastly, a question I ask all the writers who come on the podcast, and that is, what's your favorite Stacey book and why?
So I've always had trouble with favorites and that kind of question, but I think right now there are so many wonderful writers and Stacey books out there that one doesn't necessarily come to mind. Having said that, I can talk about a few of my favorites. I loved Mira Jacobs' Good Talk. I think it shifted something for us in the conversation about race and about being a brown person in this country, about certainly where we are post-Trump. Well, I'm hoping that it's post. Aga Shahid Ali's The Country Without a Post Office is one of my favorite books of poetry still. And as I was thinking about your question, I have not read this in a long time, but I loved Mira Sayal's Anita and Me. I think mostly I love that there are so many more Stacey books out right now that it no longer feels like it's this narrow category with little room left for anyone else after Jhumpa Lahiri and Arundhati Roy. There are some really wonderful books out there. When I had my Arngeithrum when I was 17, the family of friends' parents gave me a book called, this was 1990, the Ohio State University Press, Contemporary Indian Poetry. And, you know, it's Meena Alexander is there, Kamala Das is there, Nisim Ezekiel, this beautiful poem, poet, lover, bird watcher, which I love to teach. Vikram Seth is there. I mean, it's just, it's a different era.
Yes, yes, and we're all the more richer for it, thank goodness.
I'm grateful. I had certainly hoped to publish a book earlier than this, but it's also really interesting, I think, this moment that we're, that our books are coming out in, I think.
It is. I think, you know, we were talking just before we got going here about, you know, what a year to have a debut book coming out. But at the same time, you know, if the book, you know, meets a certain mindset or a certain need today in this climate, that says a lot.
It does, that right? It reminds me,
I think.
I think this is also, you know, just the passage of time, that our books are also, you know, what we read and what resonates for us is coming out of a particular moment, right? When you read something 5 years later, you have a different relationship to it.
Exactly. And I mean, just talking about, to your point about resonating, I was seeing some of the responses to that essay of yours,
Betsy,
over the weekend, you know, the Betsy, let me get it right, Betsy Tacy Sejal Tim. Just the order, I keep getting it wrong in my head. but that essay, and how, you know, I'm seeing second generation Desi people responding to it, and I saw somebody say that, you know, first time they had seen some, you know, nostalgia about being a second generation American, because we're so used to seeing the first generation American, you know, Indians or Desis, you know, being nostalgic about back home, you know, and this was a totally different kind of thing. So it's obviously resonating with folks even in this climate, which I think is terrific. And so on that note, you know, I want to again wish you all the very best with this beautiful, beautiful essay collection. I'm just so grateful for having had, you know, the chance to have read it, to have talked with you. And you know, I'm sure it's going to do great, and I look forward to seeing more and more good reviews.
Thank you
and
so
responses
much, Jenny. You know, I just I saw that comment on Twitter too, and I wanted to tell you that's, I think, one of the things I've found hardest of, I think, trying to explain about my book or to communicate about it, is that it is in many ways selected. It's, I wouldn't call it collected essays, because I've written many essays that are not in this book. But the first version of that essay, when it was a short story, I probably wrote around 2002, and then it was I revised it, and it was published in 2004. So it's really interesting seeing that was published in a print anthology that Pooja Makajani edited by Seal Press, called Under Her Skin: How Girls Experience Race in America. And so so it was published, but it didn't have this kind of audience, you know, with it being online and then in a book. And so it is really interesting to see the perception of it now and how that's changed. And it reminds me that books have a life of their own, our writing. It's not just this moment. But I remember reading Jane Eyre, and I loved The Great Gatsby, actually, and just thinking, oh, this is amazing. I'm having a conversation with writers who are no longer with us, but through their work.
Yes. Yes, I think you're right about essays or writing or books having a life of their own, because we keep evolving as people, right? And so when we come to something after a certain period of time as readers, we're not the same people we were when we read it ages ago. And I know that I'm responding to certain things in your collection differently today than if I had read it even a year ago.
Had a friend say, oh, I'm so sorry that this, you know, that people said things like that to you in graduate school. She was responding to Skin, you know, this is what the white boys say or whatever. And I was thinking, God, that's so long ago now. I don't, for me, that it does almost feel like a short story. It doesn't feel attached to who I am now. And that I think is a really interesting thing about having published essays that were written over a long period of time. So I personally have a different relationship to them based on when they were written and the time period I was writing about. It's another world now.
Right. Yes, it is. Yes. Well, thank you so much, Sejal. I really appreciated this talk, and I look forward to sharing this.
Thank you so much, Jenny, for creating this forum and having a place for us to have these conversations. I appreciate it very much, and I've enjoyed listening to what I have.
In today's They See Books giveaway segment, we have a book, a new novel, actually, by Fawzia Karimi. It's called Above Us, the Milky Way. Fawzia Karimi was born in Kabul, Afghanistan. She immigrated to the U.S. in 1980 after the Soviet invasion of the country. Karimi has a background in studio art and biology. She received her MFA in creative writing from Mills College, California. Her work explores the correspondence on the page between the written and the visual arts. She's a recipient of the Rona Jaffe Foundation Writers Award and has illustrated The Brick House by Micheline Haronian-Markham and Vagrants and Uncommon Visitors by A. Kendra Green. She lives in Texas. Karimi's debut novel, Above Us, the Milky Way, is about a young family forced to flee their war-ravaged homeland in Afghanistan, forced to leave behind everything and everyone beloved and familiar. Old family photographs and lush watercolor paintings based on medieval illuminated manuscripts interweave, with remembrances, ghost stories, stories of the dead, and fairy tales to conjure a story of war, of emigration and immigration, and the remarkable human capacity to experience love and wonder amidst destruction and loss, and how to create beauty out of horror. You'll hear more about the book from the writer next, and all you have to do to participate is enter your name and email address at the link in the transcript. There's no catch, and your information will not be used for any other purpose. And this is an optional request, not a requirement. But please do, if you feel like it, share the tweet or post with a friend using the hashtag #TheySeeBooksGiveaway. This won't affect your chance of winning the book, but it will certainly help the book get more visibility as it deserves. There's also a set of beautiful bookmarks that Fawzia plans to include with the book for the winner. And again, you can enter the giveaway at the link provided in the transcript, or just go to bit.ly/theyseebooks-giveaway. And again, I'll link it in the transcript.
Above Us, the Milky Way is a novel based on my early childhood, the war in Afghanistan, and my family's immigration from Afghanistan to the U.S. in 1980. It's a story about the horrors of war, about loss of life and loss of innocence, about torture, state-sponsored murder, the war dead, exile, and immigration. But it's also about joy, wonder, family, love, and the beauty of the night sky. The novel is comprised of over 200 individual pieces, which range in length from from a single line to several pages. As a writer and a reader, I love the idea of playing with form and structure and really leaning into the potential that books, novels especially, allow for such play. My book is structured as an abecedarium, an alphabet book. In Above Us, the Milky Way, the backbone of the novel is the alphabet. Each letter of the alphabet is accompanied by a written piece, as well as by an image. And these 26 pieces are mainly told in the first person, in the narrator's voice. They act as signposts through the rest of the novel. The majority of the other written pieces are told in the third person and take various forms. There are pieces that are short fairy tales, some that tell about individuals that died during the war, others that describe the family members and their activities or their inner lives, and still others about the stars and the sky. I'm also a visual artist, and image is very important to me. Image can enhance a story or tell it in an entirely different way. There are two kinds of images throughout my novel. Some of the written pieces are accompanied by old family photographs taken in various places and at various times, including Afghanistan before the war, India, where we spent a month before heading to the West, Germany, and finally California. My own watercolor paintings illuminate many other stories in the book. These paintings were inspired by both Eastern and Western illuminated manuscripts. There's nothing that I love more than books and their structure, both their physical structure, their weight and functionality in the hand, and the endless potential for creative structure within their pages. But I'm going to travel further back than books in choosing my all-time favorite Desi story. I choose the oral fairy tales told to me when I was a very young child in Afghanistan. Not a particular tale, but the tradition of the family gathered around a storyteller in the winter months. The storyteller in our family was my Aunt Guljon, one of my mom's older sisters. Should we happen to be at her house, should it happen also to be cold and snowing outside, should she happen to have a free hour or two or three between the cooking of meals, then she would put on the tea, gather all the children around her, place quilts over our laps, and place before us dried fruits and nuts, her own baked sweets, a cup of tea, and then tell us the fairy tales that she'd heard herself as a child from her family storyteller, her uncle. My love for story, for wonder, and for adventure come from this, winter afternoons that produced a feast of tales, each fairy tale told and listened to with relish. So that you have a sense of the book itself, I'm going to read a short piece from my novel Above Us, the Milky Way, one of its earlier alphabet pieces. This is the letter B. B. Before. All that happened and existed before the war, in the land that birthed the seven of us. In the beginning, there was life, simple. Then the war arrived. In an instant, much happened, and suddenly we found ourselves upon a new shore and looked about us, at the sand, the waves, the bright star overhead. But what was there before, and the first land, in the beginning? Bud na bud, there was not, in the beginning, a family. A great and an ever-growing family composed of a matriarch, our grandmother, my mother's mother, the only grandparent living when I came into the world, many aunts and uncles, mostly on my mother's side, and many, many cousins of all ages and heights, with myriad interests and manners, ensuring that we each had a friend of our own when we went visiting. And there was much visiting. There was food and feasting, tea served endlessly, sweets set out in great cascading hills, pillows piled on cushions laid over limitless red rugs. There was a regular celebrating and commemoration of births and birthdays, circumcisions and graduations, holidays and anniversaries, of life, great and small, of loss, great and small. There were many stories, those told and those unfolding, bud na bud, much talk and sharing, gossip and soothsaying. There was laughter and joy and life spread and interweaved across an entire country. We had my mother's grand family in the city and my father's small family of simple farmers who lived in a village hundreds of miles in a winding mountain pass away. There was travel between the two, and always adventure and play. Wagon rides and tree swings. Carrots tugged out of the ground. Corn twisted off tall, whispering stalks. Goats, chickens, cows, and dogs to feed, chase, and climb. A gurgling brook and the strawberries that grew on its banks. Hills covered with dwellings, dwellings bursting with life. Streets filled with the traffic of pedestrians, vendors, cars, buses, and bicycles. Connecting all were neighbors, grocers, barbers, midwives, tailors, each like kin. There were markets and movies, street peddlers and their singular calls accompanying a rainbow of balloons or mounds of blood-red beets, which bobbed and peaked over the garden wall. There were rivers and picnics and the bright-colored, soft-curved automobiles that delivered us there, parades and television shows, school and friends and painted pictures of sweet, ripe watermelon or sailboats crossing bright blue seas. And then there was war. In an instant, much happened, and suddenly. And war, on entering, obliterated everything and all. War, on entering the peaceful scene, turned it upside down and inside out. It shattered, severed, distorted, erased, violated, obliterated life, great and small. Harmony, great and small. Feeling, great and small. Wonder, great and small. What was a flower to war? A child to war? A culture, a melody, a river, a picnic, a ritual, a statue, a farmer, a fairy tale, a people, a memory, a taxi driver to war? So the buildings and the farmlands and mountain passes were bombed. So the people were disappeared, raped, tortured, dismembered, swallowed whole. So the children's senses became keener, the adults' minds numbed, their skin crawled. So the horror straddled and settled over the land. In the beginning, there was war. Before the war, there was family, there was life, simple. See how little patience I have for the orderly telling of things.
You've been listening to episode 9 of Desi Books, news and views about Desi literature from the world over. Tune in next week for episode 10. Follow on Twitter at DesiBooks or Instagram at Desi.books and tag the account if you have requests or suggestions. You can email at hellodesibooks@gmail.com. Stay healthy, keep reading, and write well.